Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And actually, we've got Tammy Young back with us. Welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
And you're reading the Constitution, and I'm ranting over it. So what we're actually going to cover right up front is a violation, and I believe, and I'm going to get your opinion on this, I believe this is an egregious violation. Before, as you look at this first part of Article 1, Section 6, and we're using the color-coded Constitution, Article 1, Section 6 basically is orange, which means this is a bad, this is a severe one, but not egregiously, just, you know, astronomically severe. And I honestly believe it is egregiously, and, you know, I'll just say, so severe that this is the core to our corruption. Because when you read that very first line, that very first sentence, and that's what I want you to do, is go ahead and read that, and then let's discuss whether we're abiding by that and whether the way it is being done today is such an egregious violation that it needs to change to basically red with yellow font. Go ahead and read that first sentence.
Okay. The senators and representatives shall receive a compensation for their services to be ascertained by law and paid out of the Treasury of the United States.
Okay, does it anywhere say that they're to receive emoluments for their existence?
No.
Do they get paid for doing nothing?
Oh, yeah, definitely not.
Okay, so it says very specifically they are to receive a compensation for services.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they already get their own time off. So that doesn't mean they get paid vacation. See my point?
Right.
Only for services.
Well, they also get retirement.
Well, hold on here. I want to just really dive into what are they getting? What has been enumerated here? This is something that is actually a standard. This is not something that they can just willy-nilly change, right? This is not a power given to them that they can pay themselves whatever they want to. And as a matter of fact, when we get into the 27th Amendment, they want to make sure that that compensation cannot change until after they get reelected, because the compensation will kick in the next term of service. They wanted to make sure that this was not a position of emoluments and pay, where they elevated themselves above everybody in society. Today, if you get elected to the House of Representatives or to the Senate, and you're a pot poor person like AOC, AOC barely had, I think she was a renter. She didn't have any property, and she hardly had, you know, any property at all, like clothes, cars. I don't even think she had a car. Today, she's a millionaire. How is that happening? How is that happening? Because bottom line, they should be tied. And this actually speaks of the fact that one, all of their forms of compensation and their ability to be able to invest in stocks and things that, you know, they have insights to. It doesn't even matter if they have the ability to regulate and control, because constitutionally they have no ability to regulate and control, to influence anything. Only those things enumerated. In other words, they don't have economic controls. There's no enumeration in this Constitution to control our economy. The fact that they control the SEC, the fact that they control the different market spaces of lumber, energy, all of these types of things, and creating regulations and policies over those, where they can actually benefit by going in and going, we know that these companies are actually going to have a windfall because we just created regulations for solar, wind, and these other things to, you know, be inflicted upon the people. And we know who's going to be gaining from that, and we're going to make bank on it.
Right.
This is a complete fleecing of America. Because the Constitution does not allow them to receive that kind of compensation. But it does, and it doesn't allow them to be involved in those types of things. This is, we're supposed to have a free market. Our economy today is a mercantile system, and the federal government controls every facet of our economy. The Constitution does not say that they have the ability to do that. And as a matter of fact, when we get into the enumerations of powers in just two more sections from now, we're actually going to find out that they don't even have the power to regulate a state or what a state is doing commerce-wise or anything. My point is, should this not be red with yellow font? Because red with yellow font is probably one of the most egregious, because bottom line, There's this fundamental tenet of Christianity or Judeo-Christian principles that money is the root of
all evil.
There we go. So if that's to be true, then they actually contained this very well by saying that they can only receive compensation for their services, not a retirement, not vacation. No compensation for anything other than services. Now, let's back up a second, because they do actually provide compensation for employees who actually have a job. You know, like we have a selective service where it is a voluntary military. So to get people to enlist and to join the military, they actually have the power, because they have the power to maintain and form the Navy and maintain the Navy. They have the power to do these things, which means that they have the power to create a compensation package to actually attract people to join. In other words, mm-hmm. We can give you a retirement. They can do those things for those people. They can't do it for them. They can't do it for themselves. And so, and the reason why, because you may not know this, but GR always rants a little bit about this. When I joined the military, I was promised free medical and dental for life if I did 20 years. And guess what? After doing 20 years, I do not have free dental and free medical. I actually have to pay for my dental and pay for my medical.
Mm.
So keep in mind, when you are in an org, you know, you're working at a group or organization that wants to recognize and support your veterans, don't ask us to stand up and don't applaud us. What you should do is you should say, we have done, you know, we have allowed the government to treat our veterans so poorly that they've been robbed of their entitlements and their contractual entitlements. We need to stand up and make sure that they get, because I don't want to be applauded, but I do want what I was promised in the contract of my service.
Sure.
And so if you really want to support the veterans, which in just a month and a half or so, we've got Veterans Day coming up. If you really want to support the veterans, start demanding that the government honor their contracts to the veterans. That was one of the biggest contentions after the Revolutionary War and at the beginning of the of this Congress, of this new formed government. George Washington actually had to intercede at a point in time when the veterans actually organized and marched upon the government to say, we demand our compensation. He actually had to go in and basically, you know, get these guys to say, you know, stand down. Don't take up arms against your government. Because they were that upset, because they were lied to, and the government was basically just putting up their hands going, we really don't owe you, do we? That was a different government. Anyways, let's go ahead and move on, because if we can cover most of this to getting into Article 8, because Article 8 is going to take some time, or not Article 8, Article 1, Section 8. So go ahead and finish the rest of this and then all the way through. And what we're looking at, again, these are all standards. In other words, these are hard requirements that are not negotiable. This is what they get. They can't just create a law to change it. Go ahead.
They shall in all cases except treason, felony, and breach of peace be privileged from arrest during their attendance at the session of their respective houses and going to and returning from the same. Before any speech or debate in either house, they shall not be questioned in any other place.
And actually, I need to interrupt you because clearly right here, they're above the law. Except in treason, felony, and breach of the peace. In other words, if they actually break the law and they actually are doing something that might cause harm, then they're not protected. But in every other case, they have this privilege from arrest. Go ahead.
No senator or representative shall, during the time for which he was elected, be appointed to any civil office under the authority of the United States, which shall have been created or the... how do you say that word?
Emoluments,
whereof shall have been increased during such time, and no person holding any office under the United States shall be a member of either house during his continuance in office.
Okay, so an emolument is basically another form of pay, a fee that they get, like an honorarium. In other words, they can't receive any compensation or any benefit. That's a benefit. An emolument is a benefit offered. And so, bottom line, they cannot receive any other emolument, paid vacation. They're only to receive compensation for their services. So this actually further supports this whole concept. Okay? All right. So now let's dive into Section 7.
Okay. All bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives, but the Senate may propose or concur with amendments as on other bills.
Okay. So if it's going to actually spend money, they actually have to have in the bill the mechanism of how they are to pay for that spending. So all things raising revenue, which means all things spending money, means that they need to raise revenue that has to be included in that bill, and it has to originate in the House of Representatives. So people want to understand, why is it that we have a House of Representatives and we have a Senate? Because when they laid this out, the design of the Constitution was granting the people's representatives the things that were near and dear to the people, that the Senate would have those things, responsibilities of bills and functions of government that would be near and dear to the heart, like, or not to the heart, to the states, I mean. So when we look at a treaty with another government regarding trade, does that really affect the people more, or does it affect the states more? It actually affects the states more, especially if one treaty creates an advantage for some of the states and a disadvantage for other states. Even though it does affect the people, the states want to make sure, and that's why they gave this cognizant responsibility, this oversight to say, Senate, you're supposed to be protecting the suffrage of your state legislatures, so you have to have these responsibilities, and you, House of Representatives, you're supposed to be protecting the people and their interests. So in other words, if you're going to tax the people, then it has to originate in the House. If you're going to declare war, that actually has to originate in the House, because war affects the people, definitely. And so that's why it was designed the way it was. This really comes down to, when you look at what's happening in your legislature, when you look at what's happening in Congress, specifically here, the House of Representatives are voting, in other words, they are basically representing the suffrage of the voters. In other words, as they vote on a bill, they're voting for what they believe would be best for their constituents. Now, they don't do that today. They're basically voting against their constituents by creating more and more tax and doing more and more things that they have no authority to do. So basically, they're running roughshod over the people. The Senate is, you know, focused a little bit different. They're focused on the, you know, the treaties and the appointments of the executive branches and the judiciary, those types of things, of international affairs. They're not to be focused necessarily on the domestic stuff, but they have an equal share in making sure that, you know, they also have to declare war. But where these things originate is where it was deemed most important for either the people or the people's government, the states. So that's why it was divided between two separate bodies. One body was offering suffrage for the people. The other body was offering suffrage. In other words, they were voting on behalf of. Okay? Does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay. So, go ahead.
Every bill which shall pass the House of Representatives and the Senate shall, before it become a law, be presented to the President of the United States. If he approve, he shall sign it. But if not, he shall return it with his objections to that House in which it shall have originated. He shall enter the objections at large on their journal and proceed to reconsider it.
Hold on here.
Okay.
So GR is going to be honest because you hear me attack the Convention of State folks. The Convention of State folks have nothing. They do not offer anything that protects us. It's term limits, you know, redefine the things that don't need to be done. And so what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to show you some points. Like, we already showed you one point of secrecy, that the federal government has this carte blanche control and they get to decide what's secret, what isn't secret. And I don't think in a representative government, they should have that full carte blanche power. And I believe that that requires really a very serious look of how the states need to amend that to make sure that they actually have the full oversight to say, no, you don't. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. So here's another one right here, that when a bill is passed by the House of Representatives and the Senate, that the president has the ability to veto it. Now, they made the assumption that every bill that would be passed would be within the framework of the Constitution. In the Constitutional Convention and in the ratification debates, nobody mentioned that there would be efforts by both the House and the Senate to pass bills that would actually be attacking the Constitution, the states, and the people. It was unfathomable that they would even do that. But they did inject with this little thing called the veto by the president, that the president could actually reject it based on his objections and send it back to where it originated. And then they're going to go into how it can be overturned by 2/3 of both houses, which you haven't covered yet. But this is this little dance of politics. Now I'm going to state the obvious. It should actually include that if a bill is deemed by the president as unconstitutional, or deemed by any person in the House of Representatives or the Senate, that this bill is not within the enumerated powers, it should kill it completely. And I'll even take one step further. The originator, the person that brought such bill forward, where it was presented and voted on, that person who actually tried to get an unconstitutional bill to be passed should be removed immediately. Is that not stating the obvious?
That would be really nice.
So, in other words, you only have Congress the authority to create laws over these things that are delegated to you. And had they done this, this would have stopped the ability of creating the bank. That it needed to be literally clear here that any law, any bill, any expenditure, any revenue had to be directly a derivative of the enumerated powers. In other words, it had to be very explicitly from that. In other words, it had to be necessary. Because remember when we went through the bank bill, and Thomas Jefferson actually proved, does the federal government need a bank to create debt? No. They need somebody to borrow money from to create debt. they have the ability, through the ability of treaties, to basically create a treaty of debt. They have the ability to print money. They have the ability to to tax. In other words, they didn't need, there was no necessity for the bank. And so,
but they did it anyway.
They did it anyway because Congress decided, and this was the point, I believe, when Hamilton basically got many members of Congress eating out of his hands because, hey, look at this trough of power we have. We can do these things. And now if we have a bank, you can actually invest and become a stockholder in the national bank. John Adams himself was a heavy stockholder in the national bank. So when the National Bank went bankrupt, John Adams lost everything. It was a huge shame upon the Adams family. And that was in the early 1800s. John Adams had to move in and live with his son, John Quincy Adams. Him and Abigail lost everything. It was a huge embarrassment for them. And these people were people of integrity. And John Adams, because he was, I don't want to say a sycophant, but because he actually listened to Hamilton, that's what caused these problems. So, sorry for going down this little rat hole. Just, we got 3 minutes. Let's see if we can get through the rest of this one paragraph right here. Go ahead.
Okay. If after such reconsideration, 2/3 of the House shall agree to pass the bill, it shall be sent together with the objections to the other House, by which it shall likewise be considered. And if approved by 2/3 of that House, it shall become a law. But in all such cases, the votes of both Houses shall be determined by yeas and nays. And the names of the persons voting for and against the bill shall be entered on the journal of each House respectively. Any bill shall not be returned by the President within 10 days, Sundays excepted, after it shall have been presented to him. The same shall be a law in like manner as if he had signed it, unless the Congress, by their adjournment, prevent its return, in which case it shall not be a law.
Okay, so here's an interesting little point, because you hear people say that there's no Christian values in the Constitution. They did not allow Sunday to be counted as a day of work. Right? Right there.
Yeah.
Sunday's accepted. So the other thing is that they're really kind of covering this fact that these things that are going to be considered laws in pursuant to the Constitution, a bill in pursuance to the Constitution, not some things that they're doing on the side, but actually something that's going to affect the people in the states, it requires a record of the vote. Remember, we read before that if the House is going to do something and they vote to have, you know, a catered lunch, you know, because they're going to have a working lunch and they vote for that, then, you know, 1/5 of the people could say, hey, we want to vote on this. We want to record the vote of who's going to vote for their own lunch, you know, the catered lunch. So my point is that there's a big difference between some of the perfunctory stuff where 1/5 could call for. The Constitution demands that everything that affects the people and everything that affects the states, when they're passing bills that can become law in pursuance to the Constitution, must be recorded. Okay? And so we do have a second here with this last paragraph. I'd rather wait. Do you have any questions? Because we've covered a lot.
No, just comments. I laugh because in our own house, the less conservative people have accused the more conservative people of using the counted vote, the recorded vote as a weapon.
Yeah. And actually, it right here, if it is going to affect the people or the state, or in context to a state, in a state constitution, anything that will have any effect on the people and or the county, the sub-element of government in the state, then it must be recorded. And the problem is many states do not have that. They don't have, I mean, we did a really crappy job in containing our state governments because the counties didn't understand the responsibility, nor did the people of the counties understand that they needed to create a constitution for their own county. But nonetheless, we've ran out of time. So as we move into this break, what we're going to do is we're going to have this promo, and we're going to come back, and we're going to read the last paragraph of Section 7, And then we're diving into the meat of the Constitution, the one place where we'll find the enumerated powers that are specific for Congress to create law. It's only here, folks, where they have the power to create law. We'll be right back after this promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so now let's go ahead and move. So most of what we've been reading, all in Section 7, is really roles and responsibilities. So this final paragraph is just a continuance of the roles and responsibilities of what they're supposed to do, how they're supposed to function. And so go ahead and read the last one here.
Okay. Every order, resolution, or veto to which the concurrence of the Senate and House of Representatives may be necessary, except on a question of adjournment, shall be presented to the President of the United States, and before the same shall take effect, shall be approved by him, or being disapproved by him, shall be repassed by 2/3 of the Senate and House of Representatives according to the rules and limitations prescribed in the case of a bill.
Okay, so basically it's a perfunctory thing that this is not necessarily something that's going to become a law, but something that they're both going to do. And I'll give you a good case in point. They have exclusive legislation. When we get into Section 8, we're going to actually talk about that. And let's say they need to create a sheriff for the District of Columbia. And so the House of Representatives, basically, because it's going to cost them some money to do that, they'll create this and they're going to have to figure out how to pay for that. And it may be, you know, a tax or what have you coming into the district or whatever. But it's not something that they're passing down to the state, nor is it something that they're going to require revenue from the state. It's something they'll just have to pay for. And nine times out of ten, they did have mechanisms of doing that. But nevertheless, this is something that goes to both houses, that they all agree that they're going to create the sheriff, and then the president has to sign off on that. And so, and if the president doesn't, it still requires 2/3. So it's a perfunctory responsibility of making sure that the president has a check on what Congress is doing, and Congress has to be strenuously for doing it by 2/3 of both houses. If the, you know, to overpower the president saying you can't do it, in other words, that old veto. Now, jumping into Section 8, the very first part of this is the preamble to the enumerations of powers. In other words, there's this little declaration that's explaining why these powers are being granted to the federal government, to Congress specifically, to be able to do these very specific things. Okay, so when you read this all the way through the uniformity part, and actually that is, you know, the regular text all the way to that purple text with yellow, that is the preamble. Now, one of the things that you've been good about, because some of these things have been changed, we inserted, this has been modified by this amendment or what have you. So kudos for not, you know, having to read that and not reading it, because that nine times out of ten confuses people. But go ahead and let's read this preamble so that we can pick it apart or kind of understand what it is. Go ahead.
Okay. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts, and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, but all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States.
Okay, so they're getting all of these powers to borrow money, to regulate commerce amongst foreign nations, to establish a uniform rule of, you know, naturalization bankruptcies, to coin money, all of these things that are going to follow. They're doing this basically, as it says here, to pay the debts, you know, to raise the money and to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and the general welfare. So this is not granting them the ability to create welfare. This is a declaration of why they're doing this, for the benefit of the states and for their security and just basic general welfare, how they just generally benefit for the federal government doing these things. The key thing here, because this is pretty much in the preamble, kind of like it's called a power because this is where the powers are, but this is a preamble for the power. So one of the things I need to do in the enumerations is really clarify this, because this beginning is really more of a role, responsibility, and a standard. In other words, this is something that they cannot use to create law. This is something that they can't change. And I'm going to emphasize this. The last part of this, all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. That is a hard standard. Congress cannot create progressive taxations, progressive duties, progressive income tax. In other words, it must be uniform throughout the states. If you're going to tax the people money on their income, then whatever percent you come up with must be uniform throughout the United States. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Which means when we're looking at this fact that they actually have this progressive tax system, taxing the rich more than the poor, this is how they've weaponized themselves, basically attacking those people who are working hard, and they incentivize people to not work at all, because they've actually taken control of the purse and actually using money by taking money out of one person's hands and then basically handing that money because, oh, well, you don't have money, we're going to give you money. They don't even have that power here. When we go through this, you will not find any power of administering welfare, period. So now we're going to go through the powers, but I just wanted to make sure that one, that what you just read was a preamble, but in locked into that preamble was a hard standard that they had to be uniform. Yeah. When you read, and when we read the 16th Amendment, you will realize, because you actually have that part highlighted, that part that's a standard, all duties imposed, that right there is identified as a violation against the Constitution, that there's an amendment out there that's violating this part, or the way it's being applied is violating this part of the Constitution. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, the 16th Amendment is the amendment that is violating that part, because they actually do have progressive taxation. So start off with the first subsection, the very first line, they have the power to, and so if you just think about it, Congress shall have the power to borrow money. And so that's, yeah, you know, if you do it that way, then everybody can understand that Congress, not the court, not the president, the beginning line is the Congress shall have the power. Go ahead.
Okay. To borrow money on the credit of the United States.
There you go. So in other words, they can borrow money. Does it say that they need a bank to do that?
No,
that doesn't. That means that they can actually go and borrow money, bring it into the treasury, and spend that money as necessary. Not to basically collect interest on it, not to play any games with it, not to create products such as stocks or bonds or what have you. It is to borrow money to do something below what they have these other powers to do. Go ahead. Congress shall have the power to
regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes.
Okay, so actually, when you look at and among the several states, That is a role and responsibility, not a power. The power is actually granted them to regulate commerce with foreign nations and with the Indian tribes. And in the middle, among the several states. In other words, they're to play the traffic cop. Most people, convention state folks, don't think that that's clear enough. They think that, oh, you know, we got to go and redefine it to say that they can't regulate the states directly. Well, it doesn't even say that they can. It says among the several states. Right? It doesn't say that they can regulate commerce with the states.
No.
At all. Or within the states. It says among the states. To me, it's as clear as mud. Or I should say it's actually as clear as water. But anyway, so Congress shall have the power to
establish a uniform rule of naturalization and uniform laws on the subject of bankruptcies throughout the United States.
Okay, so this means that they have the responsibility and power to create laws that reflect what it takes for an immigrant to become a citizen. Do you see anywhere here where they have the power for the importation of persons?
No.
No, not at all. In other words, they only create the standards of people immigrating. See, really, the way it was people would immigrate. They didn't go to D.C. to immigrate. When people wanted to come to the states, they said, you know what, I want to live in the warm part of the state, so I'm going to move to Georgia. I'm going to immigrate to Georgia. And so the people would actually immigrate to the states, and the federal government would actually create a uniform rule of how all the people migrating into the states. But the migration was one by one. The importation of persons, when we get to it, it'll be in Section 9, was actually granted to the states, that the federal government could not stop the states' ability to import people, or actually, I should say, not import. It's actually, what's the word? The ability to bring in a group of people, because in those days, they were actually bringing ships of people from very specific origins. They had the power for 20 years for the importation of persons for the purposes of slavery. But all other people, the states did not have the ability to just bring a whole bunch of people in. After that 20-year authorization of the importation of people, all importation of people stopped. We went to a standard immigration system where an individual had to apply. In those days, they actually just came. But when it got out of hand because we were being overrun by immigration, because life in the world everywhere was getting bad, so they said, you know what? The federal government has created this new naturalization and immigration system so that before you come here, you need our approval. It got so bad that they came to that point to say, you can't come here until we actually say you can.
Right.
And so, in other words, that is the law, and that's the basis of the immigration system today. All of these people, let me go over the ways. So the way a person could immigrate to the United States is you could actually write to the State Department, say, I'd like to immigrate. Or you could go to the embassy in your country and say, I'd like to immigrate. Or you could show up at a port of entry like San Diego or New York or Seattle and say, you know, I'm here and I'd like to immigrate. And they'd say no. And as a matter of fact, 9/11 was a great example of this. There were lots of Arabs that were here that were coming here seeking asylum, religious persecution, what have you. And most all of them were being denied that, but they were individually coming and seeking asylum. Technically, before they could actually enter, they weren't supposed to be able to just enter. The federal government was actually supposed to keep people out, only those people who were allowed. But what they did was they used this, well, you can be here as a visitor, but you have to go home. In other words, anybody can come. If you show up on the shore, they'll allow you to come and you be here for however many weeks as a visitor. You know, if you have a B1 visa, that means you've got a work visa or professional visa or something like that. In other words, you're not immigrating. You're just here to get a job and to go back so you get your experience so you can help your other country develop its, you know, economy. And that's antithetical to me. I don't understand why they did that. But nevertheless, they had a system. And the system basically said, if you come here for refugee or, you know, this, you know, sanctuary purposes, what have you, if you were denied, then you had to go back. And so there were plenty of people that were actually here that were denied that never went back because the system was being overrun, and the government actually created a system with all these problems, all these little loopholes where they actually had these illegal terrorists that were actually hiding amongst us, or, you know, because nobody knew who these people were. They literally created a system that made us vulnerable. But the whole point is that they were supposed to have this tight control on who was going to become a citizen. And the states actually had a huge role in this, but I don't want to get into that because we've kind of covered that with the citizenship and naturalization. The point is, on the other half of this one power, this one line, they had to create a uniform rules or laws on the subject of bankruptcy. In other words, this is the law. If you take a debt, all debt can be expunged through bankruptcy. However, in those days, there was this law that basically says, if you go into bankruptcy, you must serve time. In other words, they had bankruptcy jails, prison, bankruptcy prison.
Wow.
Debt prison, debtor's prison is what they called it. And so that was the standard of the law. And it was a standard, and there's no exceptions. In other words, a uniform law on bankruptcies is just that. No exceptions. This, you know, all if you have debt, it can be bank. You can go into bankruptcy. We have today an ununiform law on bankruptcies because there are certain debts that cannot go into bankruptcy, which means that it's not uniform. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
I don't know if so. That when you look at student debt, you can go buy a house. You can go and create this huge debt.
Yeah, I was just going to say student debt.
Right. So student debt is accepted, and so it clearly states here that they have the responsibility of creating uniform laws on the subject of bankruptcies. Period. They couldn't create, you know, their own. They couldn't go and say we're going to create our own loans, and you can't use these for bankruptcy. Because that gave them an advantage. They wanted to make sure that it was a level playing field for all financial institutions, for all debt out there. And they gamed the system and created a system, and now they've weaponized it by saying, now we're going to just forgive that. Because now they're actually doing the unthinkable. And so this just infuriates me that we look at these things and they have these responsibilities to create these laws, and they've actually subverted these laws by actually creating different laws that subvert them. Anyway, go ahead. Congress shall have the power to
coin money, regulate the value thereof, and a foreign coin, fix the standard of weights and measures.
Okay, so this is a power that they could coin money. Coin money. Does it say print?
Yeah, no.
No. Regulate the value of that coin in contrast to foreign coin and fix the standards of weights and measures. Nowhere here did they allow paper to be in as a currency. Now, the only way, I think it really did require an amendment when they went to the paper commutable. But I'm okay with the state saying, we'll just allow you as long as that paper is commutable to a coin. In other words, if they print out a bill, that bill has to be tied to a silver dollar that is out in some bank that you can actually take that silver dollar bill and go in and get and exchange it and commute it to a silver coin or hundreds of them to a silver bar. And gold, same. So in other words, they used to have, and that was the standard, was all bills were commutable into a gold and silver standard. When you looked at a $5 bill, a $5 bill was a $5 coin or a quarter or what have you. So as everything started changing and shifting, they did it without actually changing their power. In other words, they did it unconstitutionally when they started creating checks and paper that people could actually issue their own paper for the tender of debt, right? Because that's what a check is. I'm writing, you know, a check right. to this person that they can go to a bank and withdraw money out of that bank for the payment of debt. That is not within the Constitution. It's nice and convenient, but they to do it, they have to amend the Constitution. And then when we get into Section 10, you'll actually see that the states are constrained. They can't even pass laws to do that. But let's keep going here. So they also, Congress have the power to provide.
For the punishment of counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States.
Okay, so this right here is the first criminal jurisdiction. In other words, this is criminal law that they have the responsibility of providing for the punishment and defining that punishment and defining, you know, how those laws are to be. You know, this is if you do this, it's a violation. So, in other words, this is the one thing that they actually have criminal jurisdiction over. Okay? All right. So, the next one is Congress will have the power to
establish post offices and post roads.
Okay, so what does that mean? Most people think that they have the ability to create post roads for the postal delivery. No, they establish the routes of where the postal service will go. They don't. This is not giving them the power or authority to create roads within states. They do have, and they did have, the authority to create a highway from each capital to the District of Columbia. That was a part of, because a post, in this sense, you got post offices, but the capitals were considered posts where they needed to have a set route. And they wanted to make sure that, you know, they knew how you were traveling from the capital to the national capital. In other words, when the state started expanding and growing, and if you actually look at a roadmap, you will notice that there is an interstate highway that travels from Seattle through all the other capitals that will take you to D.C. They considered that a necessity for the purpose of common defense and welfare, but to just create roads and just to create these postal roads and so forth, not at all. But they did understand that they needed to have lines of communication, secure lines of communication, that they could ensure that, okay, when you're traveling from the capital to the capital to the national capital, then, you know, they wanted to make sure that there was some security, because we had actually in this nation, we had hostile entities, the British, the French, Indians, and so forth, that, you know, would hold you up or what have you. And they wanted to know that, okay, this needs to be a secure lane of travel. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so they had that to make sure to provide for that defense of the commerce flowing on that and so forth. But it was not the power to create all roads. It was because government and the state governments had a responsibility of interfacing with the national government. So this was one of the things that they allowed, that they said, okay, we see this as for the general welfare and the general need for the states to interface with us and so forth. So anyway, the next one is the Congress should have the power to
promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings.
Okay, so break this down for me. When you read that, what does that mean? Does that mean that they have the responsibility of having National Public Radio or National Public Television?
No, I would say no.
Okay. Does that mean that they have the responsibility of educating people?
No.
No, not at all. Okay. So what is being granted here? It's really, really specific. It's a lot of words for just a very little specific thing.
Probably just copyright.
That is right. Trademarks, copyrights, those types of things to protect intellectual property, but how long is it supposed to be?
It says limited.
Very limited. That's right. And today, what are copyrights? As a matter of fact, look at music copyrights today. They're perpetual.
Yeah.
In other words, it became a way of people controlling revenue and money. Does it say that Congress should have the power to create perpetual exclusive rights?
No. No, it does not.
Not at all. And so we hear these elitists, and I like to pick on Eric Clapton, because Eric Clapton is one of those Karens that cries and cries because he's just not making enough money off of all of his hit songs that he, you know, did 50, 60 years ago. You know, okay, they were great songs, but come on. The fact that that stuff's protected all this time, that was never the intent. And for Congress to actually go beyond limited times, they need to amend this to give the ability to create perpetual copyrights and those types of things. Because bottom line, when we look at it, this is how we're being exploited. And really, when you think about, you know, these things that are being created for the common good, but, you know, they're actually it becomes a mechanism of profit. When we actually see how corporations create some technology and they lock it down with this, you know, like Windows, you know, these operating systems and so forth. Oh, well, this is a perpetual mechanism for profit. That was not the intent here. This intent was to actually help promote the inventing and the creation and so forth. But, you know, hey, once you've had this little protection, it's open season.
And I know, but you could interpret limited to anything you wanted.
Well, for a limited time, and actually when you go into the Constitutional Convention, they literally meant, because they understood that if there was something that society could really advance, you know, and benefit from, and the whole sole purpose was to make sure that the inventor extracted a pound of flesh out of every human being for that invention, that was not considered the benefit of society. There's a benefit of protecting the ability for people to do that, but the whole point is to give it limited times so that the inventor would be incentivized to continually invent and not make a career off of one invention.
Did they talk at all about what their definition of limited was?
So actually, when you really look, and so that's, if you want to write this note down, because this is where I've never done the due diligence, but this is where you actually have to go into how they created the first copyright and patent law. What was the copyrights? I believe the copyrights were like five years or something like that. Copyrights and patents were 5 years. And the fact that they started extending them and allowing you to go beyond and on and on and on and on means that it became, because this was part of the government that got corrupt very quickly, because as long as they were running the game, because if you couldn't have a copyright, you know, after your first 5 years, then they couldn't collect more money from you. So they wanted to actually offer that so that they would make money off of it.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
So this became a self-licking ice cream cone where the government benefited as well as corporations. And with that, folks, we've ran out of time. Boy, that snuck up on us. But anyway, so we'll leave it right there with the copyrights for limited times, and we will be back with subsection 8 tomorrow. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.